I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, U.S. Secretary of Veterans Affairs Robert Wilkie. New rules kicked in a little over 2 weeks ago that will qualify many more former military service members to get their care from community health providers instead of VA facilities if they want. We'll talk with Wilkie about what that will mean for wait times, access to specialists, and record keeping. And we'll talk about other priorities Wilkie is focusing on, including veteran suicide and the vets eligible for care who are not connected with the system. You'll also have a chance to call, email, and tweet your own questions for the Secretary. Our conversation starts after a short break. Many Americans make a point of thanking members of the military for their service, and that includes veterans. But our society's obligation to the men and women of the armed forces goes beyond courtesy. We promise them that after they've completed their service, they will have access to health care for a lifetime. From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Each year, the Department of Veterans Affairs oversees the care of more than 9 million vets enrolled in the system at some 1,200 VA hospitals and outpatient clinics. As of this month, the VA Mission Act has expanded the list of options for veterans seeking care. The name is an acronym that stands for Maintaining Internal Systems and Strengthening Integrated Outside Networks. And in a nutshell, it makes up to 40% of veterans eligible to receive health care outside the VA system and have the agency pick up the tab. Some detractors worry this expansion of community care signals the start of a broad effort to privatize the VA. But as we'll hear, VA Secretary Robert Wilkie says the decision is about reducing veterans' travel times and wait times and providing better customer service to the men and women who have served us. Robert Wilkie is United States Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Secretary Wilkie, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So you come to this job not only as someone who's had a military career, but as someone who had the experience of observing military health care up close.
Oh, very much so. My family has a long history of service, going all the way, actually all the way back to the Revolution. I saw health care in the Vietnam era. I saw broken bodies come back. I saw soldiers trying to regain their footing after coming out of that conflict. It hit home. My father was a severely wounded combat soldier from the invasion of Cambodia. And on my street, the street where my high school was in Fayetteville, North Carolina, we were two blocks from the Veterans Hospital there. And the sign outside said, "The price of freedom is visible here." So when the president asked me to do this, I thought about those I had seen. And one other thing I will say, I grew up in a world where when a child was called to the principal's office, there was always a chance that my classmate was not going to a doctor's appointment, that there was bad news from Southeast Asia. And those things were with me when the president asked me to come over from DOD to take the helm.
You hadn't had previous healthcare administration experience before you joined the VA. What was your process for learning what you would need to know?
Well, the good thing was that I knew the culture, and I knew the culture of service, the language of service, which I think was 90% of what you needed to know. And that is the ability to get out and walk and talk with people, not only the people that you serve, but more importantly, the people within the institution. And I found very quickly that many of the maladies experienced by the department as a whole really came down not to technical competence or processes, but just simple leadership issues and getting out and making sure that customer service was the prime directive, but not in the way most people think of it. Most people think of customer service as you going to the counter and taking care of the person who wants to do business with you. I concentrated on customer service internally. Making sure that we weren't compartmentalized, that we talked across business barriers, and that we cross-pollinated experiences to make VA more of a modern 21st century healthcare administration than a typical government bureaucracy.
So there are more than 1,200 VA hospitals and outpatient clinics in operation today around the country. How consistent is the experience from one facility to the next?
Well, it often depends. It depends on where the facility is. It depends on what the health of the general population around that facility is. Give you an example. My hometown is Fayetteville, North Carolina. It sits underneath Fort Bragg, and it is 90 minutes away from 40% of the United States Marine Corps. That population tends to be very young. The population in West Los Angeles is very different. The majority of those VA patients come from the Vietnam era. They have very different healthcare needs, and they have needs that require services that the rest of the country is short of. Mental health, women's health, gerontology, those kinds of things. So the beauty of the Mission Act, and we can talk about the privatization charge later, but the beauty of the Mission Act is that it says very simply, if we cannot provide that veteran a service within our facility, then we give that veteran the opportunity to take the option of getting that service outside of our department. And I think that is a very, very important step forward in making sure that the veteran's health is at the center of what we do, not the institutional prerogatives of VA.
So how did the Mission Act change the rules?
Well, Mission Act changed the rules by bringing VA to 2019. I'll give you an example. Most Americans have access to urgent care. Veterans did not have that. We now give that veteran the option of using urgent care so that when he or she happens to have a cold or the flu or a sprained ankle, they are not going through the catharsis of going into an emergency room. They can do what their neighbors do. They can go to urgent care. And that actually, that cuts down a lot of the costs that we are incurring because of emergency room visits. It's also psychologically much healthier. The other thing that Mission does is it follows what most of our veterans were used to in the military. The military health insurance program, TRICARE, before that CHAMPUS, uses minutes from a military facility, wait times, wait days for health care to determine when an active duty member can go into the private sector to get that health care. I'm an example. At Fort Bragg, they could not take care of me when I was a little fella, but they sent me to Duke University. As a Wake Forest man, it pains me to say that I was taken care of by America's number one teaching hospital. But those are the kinds of things that our veterans are used to. So if we cannot provide an appointment to a first-time veteran within 20 days, and if that veteran lives more than 30 minutes away from a VA facility for primary care, then that veteran has the option of going into the private sector. For specialty care, it's 60 minutes. So it changes that. It gets away from mileage. If you look at the American West, I always say the loneliest sign in America is in Texas. It's on Interstate 10 in Houston. It says El Paso, 910 miles. We still, in 2019, in this town, we still don't understand the scale of the American West. And we have veterans who are passing up community hospitals and doctor's offices just to drive 200 or 300 miles round trip to get to a VA center. That's not right. But it also helps in major metropolitan areas like Dallas or New York City or Houston, because it may be a short distance as the crow flies, but only a crow can take advantage of that distance. Getting in the car and trying to get there in a certain number of minutes is difficult. And we have all sorts of formula within our computer system that kicked off on June 6th that we use to help that veteran find that care.
So 40% of veterans are now eligible for this community care if they choose it, as compared to about 8% before.
Right.
What are you predicting about the extent to which veterans will choose community
care? Well, I am actually predicting that veterans will continue to vote with their feet. I think the greatest untold story of the federal government, and here I am coming from the conservative Republican side of the aisle saying that the federal workforce is wonderful. You don't hear that a lot from our side. But veterans have been choosing VA health care for a long time. The Annals of Internal Medicine, which is sponsored by Dartmouth, said in December that our health care is as good or better than any in any sector of the country. The same with wait times with the Journal of the American Medical Association. Our VA customer satisfaction rates are about 89.7, almost 90%. That's unheard of. We are seeing more and more veterans come into VA. And again, they're voting with their feet. And again, I say this all the time. The military is a unique world. The culture is unique. It is indecipherable to people outside of that uniformed world, indecipherable to those families who have never experienced it. But people want to go where they can share experiences and tell stories about what they went through and have somebody on the other end of that understand exactly what it is they're talking about. The other side of this, and I will use the personal example, the tragedy of war, the wounds of war, have to be handled in a way that you just cannot replicate in the private sector, not only in terms of the temperament and bedside manner of those who deal with it, but in terms of rehabilitation. VA is a leader in prosthetics. VA is a leader in spinal cord rehabilitation, spinal cord injury. I had the unusual pleasure of telling my Canadian counterpart that I have a closer relationship with the National Hockey League than he does, because all of those wonderful things, NPR has reported on this extensively, the great work being done on traumatic brain injury that's centered on the National Football League and the National Hockey League, that's being done in the Boston VA hospital. The people that you saw in the movie with Will Smith, mm-hmm. they work for VA. And it is a stunning thing. I certainly wasn't expecting it when I came across the river from the Pentagon. But again, circle back. Culture is the key. We find no matter what age a veteran is, that veteran wants to be around someone who has had a similar life experience.
So do you have any concerns that veterans who choose community care because they drive a little less, they wait a little less, might be missing out on that kind of holistic approach that may not be right. easy to duplicate even with the right. same services?
Well, I think we can step back and see what happened during the Choice era. And for those who don't remember it, Choice was passed in the wake of the tragedy at Phoenix, the wait times, people who were dying on wait lists. When Choice, which is much broader in terms of its impact than the Mission Act, it said you have the ability to just go out and prosper, conquer. For those in that category, less than 1% used it. And what I see in the statistics is that people, when given the option of going out, are coming back. And as long as we maintain the kind of services that professionals across the country say we have, and I believe we have, then I don't see that explosion. The one place where I do see the spike, though, is urgent care, because that is the ultimate in new medical convenience.
So can you foresee a time when urgent care is added to the list of services provided by VA facilities?
In some places, we're already putting those in, mm-hmm. sure.
How do you make decisions about where to site new facilities?
Well, let's go back to Mission Act. Mission Act says that I have to perform 96 market assessments across the country. And what does that mean? I look at populations of veterans, growing or decreasing, depending on where you are. Then, after these market assessments are over, I then have to create a commission, Asset Infrastructure Review Commission, to tell me and tell the Congress where we need to target to serve the greatest number of veterans. Let me use Texas now as sort of the epicenter of what I'm talking about. If you were looking at the states with the highest percentage of veterans in the country, Texas would be number two. In 5 years, it's number one. California drops to three. Florida is two. Texas veterans population is exploding, and we need more assets to come into the Lone Star State to serve that population.
All right, we'll talk more about that in just a moment. My guest is U.S. Secretary of Veterans Affairs Robert Wilkie. We're talking about making the VA work for veterans. From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Robert Wilkie. He is U.S. Secretary of Veterans Affairs, and we're talking today about making the VA work better for veterans. Secretary Wilkie, you were talking before the break about a state like Texas actually exploding in terms of its population of veterans. So how are decisions made about where to potentially put new facilities and where to cut back perhaps staff and capacity in places where there aren't as many veterans?
Well, it is an issue that the entire country is facing as the population of America shifts to the South and the Southwest. Right now, if you were to look at the states with the highest numbers of veterans, you would see California, Texas, Florida, and New York and Pennsylvania would be in the top 10. In 2025, Texas, Florida, California, and then North Carolina and Georgia following it. So what we have to do is we have to be given authority to get rid of buildings that we don't use. I have more than 500 buildings, most of them over 100 years old, that I cannot use for veterans. I have to be able to get rid of those and get them off of our books. The other thing I have to do is come up with a presentation to the Congress after our commission concludes its work to say this is where the veterans are. Doesn't mean that we're going to be like BRAC, because BRAC, the Base Realignment and Closure Commission, started with a very different premise. The military does not have to have a base somewhere. There's nothing written in law that says Fort Hood has to be Fort Hood or outside of Killeen. But the law says that we have to have veterans facilities in each state and within a certain mileage from veterans populations. So that's different. But what the Air Commission will do is tell us that instead of continuing to staff up in some parts of the country, we take those staffers and we place them in Texas and North Carolina and Florida to meet the growing veterans population. In Fayetteville, North Carolina, we're getting 2,000 new veterans a month. That's a huge, huge number. And we have to be able to take care of them. And it's not a complete closure like BRAC, but it is a realization that we have to go where veterans are.
As of last year at this time, June 30th of 2018, the VA reported more than 45,000 unfilled vacancies. Yeah. Where are those vacancies most critical? How much progress has been made toward getting those positions filled?
Well, I'll give you my military reaction when I saw those numbers. The first thing I asked were those numbers would like to have or need to have. And I think there was a confluence of both of those streams. So it wasn't 45,000. However, there was a greater problem.
Those are the VA's numbers.
That's right. There was a greater problem. My first week, I had two senior people come in and I asked them how many people did VA employ. They gave me two different figures. So I asked a military question, where's your manning document? And a manning document is a document that says, here are your requirements and here are the people you need to meet those requirements, and we didn't have one. So I was able to convince the senior leaders of the Air Force Personnel Office to come over and create a new HR system, similar to what I described as the Asset Commission, in that we are targeting those needs that are most immediate, and we put people where they need to be. Case in point, VA needs women's health professionals and mental health professionals and primary care physicians. We need those more than any.
So that's where the biggest shortages are.
That's where the biggest shortage. And we have the same shortages that the private sector has. So target that. Those lists that VA had, and I didn't become the secretary. My first full day on the job was August of last year. Those numbers were put together in an ad hoc way. So someone, let's say here at DC VA, said, you know, I'd really like to have five psychiatrists more. And that went into a vacancy pool because he wanted, he didn't need them, but he would have liked to have had that to make his job easier. That sort of distorted what we actually needed to focus on.
Forgive me for interrupting. It sounds like you're saying some managers of VA facilities were padding those numbers.
Well, they were. Padding has an illegal connotation to me. I think trying to fit those numbers into an ideal world for them. Sure, I'd like to have more of what is on the table, but I can't have it. We have a finite budget. We have to deal with the world as it is and not as the world as we would like it to be.
Are there cases where facilities have asked for more staff because they feel like patients aren't being well served?
You always have that in a medical system. Case in point is Los Angeles. And I keep coming back to that because it's sort of the epicenter of so many problems that we're facing, not only as a VA, but as a country. Los Angeles has a tremendous homeless problem. About 10% of all veterans homeless are in the West Los Angeles area. America's now starting to see that writ large from that part of the country. Opioid issues, the highest level of opioid addiction of veterans in any region of the country. So, that is an area that has to have special attention. And more is better there. Gerontology as well. I'd like to have a gerontologist in Fayetteville, North Carolina, but I don't need one because my population is young. So that's the thing that I, the atmosphere that I confronted. I want people to take a realistic look. We can't have a pie-in-the-sky approach to this.
Is the compensation comparable to the private sector?
Yes. So I have a unique position as the Secretary of VA. I don't have to live by the generic federal pay scale. What you would get being employed at the Department of Labor is not what you're going to get at VA for nurses, for doctors, for social workers. I can adjust salaries. Now, of course, there is one federal rule. You can't have anybody making more than the President of the United States. But we have comparable wages and to help us. Now, are we going to ever be able to compete with the Cleveland Clinic or Mayo or those? No. But it is not a typical federal pay scale, and I have authorities to offer relocation pay and increase reimbursement, particularly I'm focused on rural areas to get people into those areas.
When people are receiving community care and the VA is picking up the tab, how is the VA assessing whether the quality of that care is up to VA standards?
Well, we have had interactions with the private sector for decades. Yeah. When at the end of World War II, about 38% to 40% of all VA patients were in the private sector. It's hovered around there now. It's actually now, it's hovered around there most of our post-World War II history. It's down about 30-31% now, so it's actually gone down. So we evaluate our community care providers just the same way Blue Cross Blue Shield does. We send our experts out. We train people. So we have a vast network across the country. What's important about Mission Act now is that it allowed me to take 7 different community care pay scales that came about as a result of the original Choice Act and condense it to 1. So it's the same across the country. And we now have the different regions of the country up and running in terms of billing, in terms of making sure that those who had not been paid under the past system are paid first. Because if we don't take care of our private sector partners, then Choice completely collapses in on itself.
Is that paid out at a level comparable to private health insurance or to Medicare and Medicaid?
Medicare rates.
Okay. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also find us on Twitter at KERA Think. I want to talk a little bit about something that you have also said is a really serious priority for you, and that is veteran suicides.
Yes.
First of all, are veterans of the United States Armed Forces committing suicide at a rate higher than the general population?
Well, we certainly have a rate of suicide that is, it is larger than any other group in the country with, I think, and I'll go back, I think Native American women may be higher. But for veterans, that means on every day, any given day, about 20 veterans take their lives. But of those 20, two or three are on active duty. Mm-hmm. Another two or three come from the Guard and are not part of VA. And another 10 are veterans that we've never had any contact with. And the saddest part of that for me is that the majority of those 20 come from the Vietnam era. And I testified in front of the Senate Veterans Committee last week, and I said, put that in context. These are people who've had problems building since Lyndon Johnson was president. Lyndon Johnson left Washington, D.C. 50 years ago in January. Mm-hmm. That puts that in context. We now have a presidential task force on suicide prevention, of which I am the lead. I have said in testimony, I have said at the White House that if we just look at the last tragic act of a veteran's life, then we're never going to get our arms around this. We have to have a national conversation about mental health, homelessness, and addiction, because this is not just happening to veterans. When I testified in front of the Appropriations Committee a couple of months ago, that day, the Washington Post ran a piece about a high school in Utah, in a town probably nobody outside of Utah ever heard of, Herman, Utah. 8 children in that high school had committed suicide in just a year. The day of my testimony last week, 3 New York City policemen killed themselves, took their lives the day or two before I testified. We are seeing a spike all across the country. But I think where veterans care can provide a national lifeline is that we are the most visible population when it comes to addressing this issue. It is a population that every American understands at some level. And if we can get it right for us, then I think we can benefit the entire country.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, I want to go to the phones now. First up, we have Nick calling us from Austin, Texas. Hi, Nick.
Hello?
Hi, Nick. Go right ahead, please.
Hey, thanks, Chris. Secretary Wolke, I wanted to ask about suicide and what you were just talking about. My brother's a Marine, and you know what I've heard and seen is folks often aren't, you know, seeking out help when it comes to suicide, or if they are, things like the weight we were talking about are such a deterrent. So I'm wondering, you know, what kind of processes, whether it's pre-screenings or you know, different kind of assessments that can take place before or after our soldiers are deployed. Yes. You know, what kind of processes can we put in place like that that could help maybe identify problems,
sure,
like PTSD or mental health?
Sure.
And that.
Thanks for calling, Nick.
Sure. This goes, Chris, to a change in the culture. I'll go back to my father's time. 1970s, wounded, takes him 3 years to recover, goes back to the 82nd Airborne Division. The notion that he would talk with anyone about any feeling of anxiety would be anathema to that culture.
It was seen back then as weakness,
it
right?
It was seen as weakness. We are starting to crack that on the active duty side. We are telling troops it's okay to tell us if you feel anxious, if you feel depressed, or if you see those signs in your comrade. This is not the draftee army, and so I'm going to make a national security argument. In my father's day, it didn't matter. If you felt that way and you violated the code, there were 10 people in the draft line ready to replace you. And there was not a premium put on the care of an individual soldier. So that has started to change, but also of necessity since we have an all-volunteer force. For VA, the caller is absolutely right. More than half of those who take their lives do not have a mental health diagnosis. So what we have offered at VA is same-day mental health service. Since the first day of the fiscal year, October 1st, we have screened 900,000 veterans. We are following 3,000 of those because they have given us some indication that they might want to harm themselves.
Excuse me for interrupting. Screen 900,000 following 3,000?
Yes. And again, that goes back to what I think VA can offer the country in terms of a step forward on suicide and, by extension, the last frontier of American medicine, and that is mental health. I tell people in conversation that by the time my children begin to have children and they've just started college, we'll probably have turned the corner on cancer. We're nowhere, we're not even at the Sputnik stage when it comes to mental health. And that is the last great medical advance that we need to make. But in order to do so, we need to talk truthfully about it. One other thing, as the Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness, General Mattis and I were tied at the hip in terms of transitioning our veterans and making sure that they were getting the kind of care that they needed before they transitioned, talking about it, being told what was available, and how to approach VA. The other advance that we made was that those who were receiving other than honorable discharges, who would not otherwise under the law be eligible for VA benefits, are allowed to come to us for mental health services. There's a lot we have to do reviewing many of those thousands of other than honorable discharges that took place. And we didn't consider that that veteran, that soldier might have had a traumatic brain injury that nobody took cognizance of. So
a traumatic brain injury possibly caused by their service.
Right, right. So that's one of the many things that we have to look at.
My guest is Robert Wilkie. He is United States Secretary for Veterans Affairs. We're talking about making the VA work for veterans. Studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is United States Secretary of Veterans Affairs Robert Wilkie. I just want to go back for a moment, Secretary, to something you said about screening veterans. You said 900,000 had been screened for mental health problems. 3,000 were being actively followed. By my count, that's like 1/10 of the people that are in the VA system now. And that doesn't count the twice again as many people who are eligible for VA care that aren't receiving it and aren't connected to the system.
Right.
So Does 900,000 screened for mental health problems sound like enough to you?
Oh, no. But it's a tremendous start. And the new systems that we have in place, we are making sure that we start the process of screening everybody. Certainly, we screen everyone who's new, but we're trying to catch up. And the numbers are illustrative of a change in terms of approach. And a change in attitude when it comes to the seriousness of mental health problems in this country. I think it's tragic that of those who take their lives, half of them have no diagnosis, and I'm guessing that most of them probably would be helped if we were able to make that determination.
What is the Veterans Crisis Line? How does that work?
Well, the Veterans Crisis Line is a number that receives about 1,700 calls a day. And it is available to veterans who are in great distress. About every day, we actively intervene in 200 to 300 cases. We get people either in touch with someone or we have an active intervention. We have call centers up across the country. And one of the myths that I've heard in the last few weeks is that a member of Congress said that if you call it, you go into voicemail. That's not true. It has no voicemail capability, and the average wait time is about 8 seconds. But it is, it's one I hope veterans use, 1-800-273-8255. If you need us, call us. We will do everything we can to help you. I will talk about real quickly about the tragedy and how hard it is to get our arms around and in touch with this issue, and why these deaths are not connected in any linear fashion. Of course, there's the complexity of the human brain and heart. But the last suicide that we experienced in the VA was in Cleveland, Ohio. The veteran was looking at life-altering surgery. They were going to remove an eye, his jaw, his vocal cords. And he came, took his life on our campus, and asked us, left a note, wanted us to take care of his mother. That we will never be able, no matter how much money we put into a project or how many programs we create, combat all of the human condition and desperation that people feel. But if we have that conversation, I think, and we make available a voice and a lifeline and a hand to people, we can start bringing those numbers down.
All right, I want to go back to the phones. Our number, 800-933-5372. We have Marvin calling us from Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Marvin.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good, good. Thanks for taking my call. Listen, I am a mental health professional, a clinical therapist, and I had a contract with the Veterans Administration, and one of the most common problems that we seem to face as external contractors was that the quality assurance program did not include a component which ensured that the veterans followed up, and if they didn't follow up, we had no real way of encouraging them to do so. And I was hoping that the new policy includes some type of quality assurance program which encourages them to do that, and if they don't, that the Veterans Administration exercises some type of influence.
Yeah.
Can you tell me if that's part of the current program?
That is. Our executive in charge of Veterans Health, Dr. Richard Stone, is implementing quality assurance and what we call high reliability organization across VA. And one of the focus points is that follow-up that you're talking about. One-offs usually lead to problems. So I can't give you chapter and verse on everything that they're doing, but quality assurance is something that the new leadership at VA takes very seriously.
What can you tell us about the veterans that are not in the system? I mean, how actively is VA working to get people incorporated into a system that can provide them health care that they have earned by virtue of their service?
Right. Well, you hit on, I think, as great a conundrum for us as dealing with suicide and mental health issues. I'll give you an example from Alaska. Alaska has the most veterans per capita of any state. More than half are not in the VA system. Now, Alaska is one of those places, sort of like West Texas or Southwest Texas, where somebody can go if that individual wants to get lost and separate herself from society.
Yeah.
We need help in finding those veterans. So when I was in Alaska in October, and I'm going back again next month, I asked the Alaska Federation of Natives, which is a huge force in that state, to double the number of tribal representatives that they have to go out and help us find those veterans. One of the beauties of the president's task force is that it will allow me to open the door on support for not only state and local governments, but for non-governmental organizations and tribal organizations to get out and help find those veterans who are out there. And that is absolutely vital. But we can't do it on our own, even though we have 370,000 employees covering the expanse of the United States is beyond what we are capable of without the kind of cooperation that we can get from charities, NGOs, states, and localities who know those places better than we do.
How satisfied are you with the functionality of electronic health records within the VA? And what happens when someone has some care provided by a VA facility and some care provided in the community?
Well, that is the great revolution, a technical revolution. I'll give you I will use an example from my family. Father, 30 years service, terrible wounds, but also the effects of jumping out of airplanes. Needs two new knees, two new hips, has a bad back, and has lead in his body that they couldn't take out. He's looking at a lifetime of pain, but he's carrying around with him an 800-page paper record. It's the only record. It's indecipherable. So Secretary Mattis and I had deep discussions about how we changed that dynamic. So we are testing out in the Pacific Northwest in Alaska a record that begins to be built when a youngster goes in to the military entrance processing station and is built during that military career and then is handed over to VA. It is not a scanner. If it was just a scanner, it's useless. It does what you just implied. If a veteran comes to the Audie Murphy VA hospital in San Antonio and he gets a prescription, let's say he gets opioids, Tylenol 3 or something for pain, and then he goes to his home outside of Houston. Let's just use that as an example. And the doctor in Pasadena gives him something to sleep, help him sleep. Because the electronic health record is interoperable, that doctor in Pasadena, Texas, can then punch in that he just gave that veteran 30 pills to help him sleep. Well, we now have an alert within the system that we have a Texas veteran who is on a scale for abuse, addiction, or worse because of a deadly combination of drugs. That is Nirvana for us, an interoperable, total life record that begins when an American is probably 17 years old, and you don't have the experience of my father and his generation carrying around this monstrosity that nobody can read because the ink's worn off or the carbon paper has disintegrated in it. It's going to be a few years, but if we are going to provide veterans modern health care, the record needs to be updated and updated in that way.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, I want to go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Akeem calling from San Antonio, Texas. Hi, Akeem.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
We're identifying that veterans are spread out all across. I mean, they are concentrated in certain areas, but the fact that there's limited resources, I believe that if there was a way to develop an app and require or at least strongly recommend that not only active duty but also veterans were able to access this app and go in, let's say, every other Friday, every 2 weeks, and just do like a self-assessment of their mental, where they are mentally, physically, emotionally, and then take all of that data within the app and prioritize where you need your resources, it would decrease the amount of people that have to find a facility to go into just to get a checkup, and two, that would decrease the cost. And
Mr. Secretary, what do you think about an idea like that?
I certainly think that VA has to come into the next decade of the 21st century with more technical applications than it has ever had before. For the first time since the fall of Saigon, our veterans population, the majority of them are now under the age of 65. We haven't had that young a population, as I said, in four decades. That means they're computer savvy. They're technically competent. They would be able to handle something like that. And that would be the target audience.
To go back a moment ago, you mentioned, you know, a vet receiving a prescription for opioids. Have they been too generously prescribed, loosely prescribed in the past?
Absolutely. Absolutely. A mindset took hold in this country, not just in VA, that you treated the brain and not pain. thankfully, VA's new protocols have seen the decrease in prescription levels by about 51%. We found that treating the actual source of the problem is the key, so we are substituting Tylenol 3 and other opioids with combinations of over-the-counter drugs, Advil, aspirin, acetaminophen, and aspirin, which we find are more effective than opioids. The other thing that we've done and changed the culture, you told my father that to treat those terrible conditions that he came out of service with, he was going to do Tai Chi or yoga. He'd have flattened my nose. But we are now the leaders in alternative therapies.
Does that work for people?
It works, and people are flocking to it. I was in Hawaii in December and watched 15 Vietnam veterans move to music therapy. These are people who had had a tough life adjusting to the pain caused by 30 or 40 years of jumping out of airplanes, war wounds, the cost of service, and to see them moving freely without having to use opioids was a revelation.
Is the VA on a course toward privatization?
No, no, it is not. And, you know, we're sitting about a mile from Capitol Hill. There are 535 members of the board of directors up there. I just presented to the Congress a $220 billion budget. It is the largest budget in the history of this department. It calls for 390,000 employees. If we're privatizing, we're doing it a very strange way. I mentioned to you earlier off mic that I am a pariah in the cabinet room. I'm the only one who didn't have to come up with any budget cuts. So we are fulfilling our mandate, and I think we're in a much better place than VA has been in the last few years.
In just the last 30 seconds, is there something that still really frustrates you about the department you're now running?
Oh, any federal department, paperwork, the inability to digitize paper and to get out of the industrial age mindset that everything has to be in duplicate and 1,500 hands have to touch a document before you see it. That's the most frustrating thing about it. In my almost year now since coming over from the Department of Defense, I could not be happier. There's no greater honor, and we have a great workforce.
Robert Wilkie is United States Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Secretary Wilkie, thank you so much for making the time for us.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for having me.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. Subscribe to our podcast and learn about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.